I call this meeting at the House Finance and Policy Committee to order. It's Monday, March 2nd, and we have a quorum present. First, a reminder about committee rules. Signs are not permitted in the committee room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, applause, or other disruptions are not allowed. Sitting or standing in the aisles is not permitted, and the State Patrol and House Security staff are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you leave the committee room, please hang on to your tickets to re-enter the room. We have a full agenda today, so we'll be limiting testimony to two minutes per person so that everyone has a chance to speak. And we're going to hold off on approval of the minutes for now and move into our agenda for the day. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3668 from Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. I'd like to move my bill before the committee.
Chair Bierman, to your bill.
Members, today, gun violence is the leading cause of death for children and adolescents in the United States. Our youngest Americans, 1 to 19. This has been the case for 5 years in a row. We all serve on this committee because we care about the health and well-being of our communities, especially our children. Generations before us sat in these seats and faced grave threats to young lives. They confronted infectious disease, childhood cancer, smoking, car crashes, and others. They followed the research. They trusted the data. They acted. And because they did, these maladies were reduced. Now, it is our turn. If this were any other leading cause of death, we would respond with urgency. We would study it. We would fund it. We would coordinate a serious, sustained response. That is exactly what creating an Office of Gun Violence Prevention would do. It would treat gun violence as the public health crisis that it is, bringing together researchers, medical professionals, educators, law enforcement, and community leaders to reduce injuries and save lives. We cannot solve what we refuse to study. The scale of the gun violence crisis is staggering. During the Vietnam War, 58,220 American servicemen were killed over a 20-year period. In 2024 alone, more than 49,000 people died from gun violence in the United States in 1 year. Between 2012 and 2021, more than 200,000 American kids suffered gunshot wounds. In just 1 year, 2021, more than 29,000 children were treated for lethal and non-lethal gunshot injuries in emergency rooms across the United States. These numbers can overwhelm us, but we cannot allow ourselves to become numb, and the deaths are only part of the story. I listened to the mother of a student from Annunciation. Chris Kelly's son was in church that day. The terror of that day has changed him in many ways. He now struggles to trust adults. He would not trust any of us. He believes adults let it happen and that we failed him. His trauma did not end when the sirens stopped. It lives in him and in his family every single day. For every individual involved, there are parents, siblings, grandparents, cousins, classmates, and neighbors whose lives are forever altered. Gun violence does not end with the bullet. The trauma ripples outward, embedding itself in the families and communities. It spreads quietly and relentlessly. For decades, research into gun violence has been underfunded and intentionally limited. We have clear data on deaths, but far less understanding of the long-term physical, mental, and emotional consequences for survivors. That gap is not accidental, and it is something we can change. I know this issue often becomes partisan the moment it is raised, but studying a leading cause of death should not be partisan. Excuse me. I said a lot of numbers, and I know one can dismiss the numbers. They are faceless. We can all just walk by the empty desks that are out on the lawn and in the hall downstairs with hardly a glance and elude any real serious acknowledgement of what two small empty desks mean. In Minnesota, in this committee, we have the power to take a serious, responsible public health approach. Establishing an Office of Gun Violence Prevention is not about politics. It is about data. It is about coordination. It is about saving lives. And our children are watching us. They are counting on us to do what adults did before us, to meet a crisis with courage and evidence, not silence. Let us choose action over paralysis. Let us be the leaders who said enough, because every child deserves to grow up. Every family deserves peace. And every life we save will be a quiet testament that we chose them. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move to testifiers, please.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. First up is Maggie Emery, followed by Lisa Mattson, Dr. Mattson. If you'd come to the testifier table, please. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dr. Lisa Mattson, and I have the honor to serve as president of the Minnesota Medical Association. With over 10,000 members across the state, we are the largest professional association of Minnesota physicians. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, more than 500 Minnesotans die by firearms each year, with this number increasing annually. You've already heard about the number of children who die, but this surpasses cancer and accidental deaths combined. Guns are also the number one cause of death by suicide, especially in our adolescent population. Behind each of these deaths is a family, a community, and often a physician who's cared for that patient. We've also witnessed firsthand the devastating physical injuries caused by firearms, as well as the lasting emotional and psychological trauma experienced by survivors and families. In recent years, the Minnesota legislature has taken important steps to reduce firearm-related harm, including expanded background checks and extreme risk protection orders. These policies matter and will save lives. But lasting progress requires more than passing laws. It requires sustained public health leadership and infrastructure that supports strong data collection, careful analysis, and coordination so preventive efforts reach the communities most affected by this public health crisis. House File 3668 would go far in that effort through a dedicated Office of Gun Violence Prevention. This office would serve as a critical partner to the medical community, strengthening the connection between clinical experience and public policy, while providing a stable and accountable structure to guide this work over time. Minnesota has successfully reduced deaths from motor vehicle crashes, tobacco use, and opioid overdoses by applying a similar framework grounded in evidence, data, prevention, and collaboration. Healthcare professionals have played an important role in these efforts, and we have seen positive results. The same approach can and should be applied to firearm death and injury prevention. This bill is about protecting the health and safety of our patients and preventing avoidable loss of life. All of you have an opportunity to one day tell your family, your friends, and your constituents that you did something to save a life. On behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association, I respectfully urge your support of House File 3668. I appreciate your time and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson. Next up, we have Maggie Emery. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to share with you today. My name is Maggie Emery, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Protect Minnesota, which is the only state-based gun violence prevention organization in Minnesota. I'm speaking today in strong support of HF 3668, the bill to establish a state office of gun violence prevention. This is not about politics. It's about stopping a pattern of harm that has devastated families and communities across Minnesota. Like many states around the country, gun violence in our state sharply increased during the COVID pandemic and the following years. However, unlike most of the rest of the country, where shootings and homicides have started to dramatically decline in recent years, Minnesota's levels of gun injury and death remain elevated. Our gun death rate increased by 35% from 2014 to 2023, with more than 20% of that rise happening in the last 6 years alone, resulting in hundreds of Minnesotans killed by firearms each year. In 2024, deaths from gun violence around the rest of the country fell by 5%, but here in Minnesota, they rose by 6%. We have seen this trend across different types of gun violence, including suicides and homicides. We don't have much research to help us understand why Minnesota is an outlier here. In Minnesota, we have a real weakness in how we collect, analyze, and respond to violence as a public health issue. Unlike jurisdictions across the country that have used investment, data-driven intervention, and coordinated responses to reduce gun violence, Minnesota lacks a centralized mechanism to marshal information, align resources, and evaluate what works. The Office of Gun Violence Prevention would do exactly that. It would bring data, research, and strategy together under one roof so policymakers, public health professionals, law enforcement, and community organizations can understand the problem and implement proven solutions with accountability. We already know that from other public health challenges, from motor vehicle safety to infectious diseases, benefit enormously from this kind of coordinated approach. Minnesotans deserve a public health approach to gun violence prevention. It's time for leadership grounded in evidence and not guesswork. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Emery. Next up, we have Casey Sharp, followed by Dr. Jewett. Thank you for being here today. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Casey Sharp, and I'm the parent of two children who attend Annunciation Catholic School. I'm here today to ask for your support of HF 3668. 6 months ago, my community experienced a horrific act of violence. My son was forced to lie under a church pew with his hands over his head as 116 bullets were fired in just 2 minutes. Five rows behind him, his best friend, Fletcher, was shot and killed. That moment is now a part of my son's story and our family's story. He was inches from death and now has to grow up without his best friend. We miss Fletcher every day. And in his third grade classroom, 10 little boys are not just learning math. They're learning how to cope with grief, fear, and trauma. After the shooting on August 27th, my son asked me what I was going to do to keep him safe. Honoring Fletcher and Harper's lives and protecting my children's future are the reason I am here today. I want to acknowledge that everyone on this committee cares about protecting children. We may not all agree on the best path forward, but that is exactly why we need an Office of Gun Violence Prevention. This office would allow us to approach this crisis with the seriousness it deserves through coordination, prevention, and data-driven solutions. As others have said, we've seen this approach work in other public health challenges like smoking and traffic safety. Real progress is possible when we invest in prevention. I want my 8-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter to grow up knowing their safety matters, that their leaders take this seriously and action is possible. We cannot accept a reality where children are exposed to this level of violence. This bill is a step forward. It creates space for thoughtful, comprehensive solutions, not just one perspective. In honoring Fletcher and Harper and so many others, I urge you to take meaningful action. Please vote yes on HF 3668. Thank you.
Ms. Sharp, thank you so much for your testimony. Doctor, you may state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Roli Dwibedi, a family physician practicing in Minnesota for more than 17 years. I'm also immediate past president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, representing more than 3,100 family physicians and medical student members across the state. I'm here in a strong support of HF 3883, authored by Representative Bierman, which would establish an Office of Gun Violence Prevention in our state. As a clinician, it is devastating to witness the toll of gun violence, whether it is a parent losing a child, or child losing a parent, or anyone losing a loved one. These untimely deaths leave a void that word can't fill. No one should have to endure the trauma of a life cut short by violence. Every week in my practice, I see the ripple effect of gun violence. I and my colleague throughout Minnesota care for children with anxiety after lockdown drills in their schools. We treat patients living with chronic pain from gunshot wounds. We counsel parents who are terrified about the safety of their teenagers. And tragically, I have lost a patient and cared for families after suicide attempts involving firearms. I cannot shake the memory of a mother's face in North Minneapolis a few years back. It was the middle of the night, her children were fast asleep, and a stray bullet had just pierced the wall of their home. The look of pure terror in her eyes is something that stays with you, a reminder of how fragile peace can be. These are not just individual impacts. This impacts families and communities. Gun violence is not an abstract policy issue to us in medicine. It is a daily public health reality. HF 3883 takes a public health approach to a very complex problem. Throughout my medical education, I was taught prevention is better than cure. When I think about gun violence and related outcomes, this bill would coordinate and promote effective efforts to reduce gun violence and related traumas. Right now, prevention efforts are fragmented across communities, nonprofits, law enforcement, healthcare systems, and state agencies. An Office of Gun Violence Prevention would create alignment, ensuring that successful strategies are shared and scaled. In medicine, we do not guess. We use data to save lives. Public policy must do the same. This office will lead rigorous Minnesota-specific research to replace guesswork with evidence.
Excuse me, doctor.
Exact risk factors.
Could you wrap up your testimony, please?
Public health campaigns save lives. We have seen it with tobacco, seatbelt, and vaccine, and we must apply the same proven strategies. Survival is only the first step. For a victim of gun violence, the trauma doesn't end when the hospital door closes. Recovery means months of grueling rehab, the weight of the lost wages, and the invisible scars of PTSD. Collaboration is our best defense. Finally, but most importantly, this office would serve as a resource to the legislatures on gun violence prevention legislation. As members of the Minnesota House, you're asked to evaluate complex proposals with significant implication. Having a dedicated office to provide data analysis and evidence-based recommendation will strengthen the policymaking. As a family physician, I'm committed to protect and promote the health of my patient. Supporting HF 3883 is consistent with that commitment. I urge you to pass this bill and take an important step towards a safer, healthier Minnesota. And thank you for your time and considerations.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Dr. Jewett, please state your name for the record and proceed, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name.
Mm-hmm. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me testify today. My name is Trish Jewett, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. While I'm an expert in my field, I'm not speaking on behalf of my university. I do research on firearm injury prevention in a range of settings across Minnesota. In Minneapolis, I work with community violence interrupters who prevent violence every single day. In a rural Minnesota town, we will bring together people with different political views and firearm owners and non-owners to identify firearm safety measures that work for everyone. In collaboration with Protect Minnesota, we created a pilot Minnesota map of voluntary out-of-home firearm storage options to reduce suicides. So far, these are pilots, but this work is needed in all of Minnesota. Minnesotans everywhere want to be part of the solution. But although U.S. firearm homicide and suicide rates are a global outlier, this research is underfunded. And in 2025, the funding situation went from difficult to absurdly difficult. A centralized office of gun violence prevention would not only provide some urgently needed funding, but it could also coordinate between projects and make sure that all Minnesotans benefit. Minnesota has incredibly creative researchers. Some of them promote safe storage. Some study what survivors need. These survivors include hundreds of children who lived through the horrors of the Annunciation shooting and hundreds of black, brown, and white children who lost a loved one to violence or suicide. These children do not just go back to their old lives. They are our future, and we owe it to them that we help them. But we can only help them if we find out what they need. Again and again, Minnesotans have shown that we are at our best when we care about each other. An Office for Gun Violence Prevention would help Minnesotans to do just that, protect each other. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Jewett. Next up, we have Dr. Beth Elfstrand, followed by Ms. Anna Leamy. If you'd please come forward. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Beth Elfstrand. I'm a member of American College of OBGYN. I'm also a member of the MMA. I'm a recently retired OBGYN. I practiced here in Minnesota for 31 years, and I'm in strong support of HF 3668. As an OBGYN, I've always been focused on women's health and especially maternal health. I was one of the founding members of the Minnesota Maternal Review Committee, and I served on that committee for over 10 years. We all hear about the maternal mortality health crisis. We think of things like pregnancy-related things, hemorrhage, hypertension, infection, embolism as the main causes. It became very clear to me when I was doing case reviews, one after the other, that we were seeing more and more injury-related deaths. And what was very alarming to me and other members on the committee was that women who died by suicide were using such a lethal and violent means as a firearm. When I was a medical student at the University of Minnesota, we were taught men use guns. Women maybe would try a suicide attempt with drugs. That is not the case. A study that came out this year by the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine found homicide and suicide to be the number one cause of maternal death in our country. That means that for too many women, the greatest threat to their survival during and after pregnancy is not a medical complication, it's a bullet. This bill addresses this crisis using a public health framework that's urgently needed. First, since pregnant and postpartum patients interact with multiple systems, such as healthcare providers, social services, mental health professionals, and sometimes the criminal justice system, having a centralized Office of Gun Violence Prevention would help align domestic violence and suicide prevention programs alongside maternal health initiatives and community safety efforts, so that they're working together, not separately. It could serve as the hub to connect efforts from all the various groups. In Minnesota, we have made great progress in reviewing maternal deaths and identifying the preventable causes, but we need to take it to the next level and do the state-specific research on how firearm access intimate partner violence and pregnancy all intersect. Without the robust data, we cannot design the interventions that protect pregnant and postpartum patients. So timely, transparent data can help us identify the trends and evaluate whether prevention strategies are working.
Excuse me, doctor, if you could wrap up your testimony, please.
Public health campaigns, like those within this legislation, are essential. We can counsel patients about seatbelts, safe sleep for infants, smoking cessation. Education changes outcomes. We should normalize the conversations about firearms in the home, safe storage, suicide prevention. And as an OBGYN, we need to look forward to the continuum of care, not just getting women safely through the childbirth process, but ensure that they survive and thrive afterwards. So we must recognize that death by firearm, homicide or suicide, are among the leading causes of death during pregnancy. This coordinated, data-driven effort would do just that. I urge everyone to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up is Anna Leamy. And Dr. Rachel Weigert. Oh, there's Anna. Thank you. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair and members, my name is Anna Leamy, Director of Government Relations and Advocacy for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. I'm here today in opposition to House File 3668. While presented as a public health initiative, House File 3668 would establish a permanent taxpayer-funded office with broad authority to shape firearm policy, influence gun control legislation, coordinate with outside organizations, and promote regulatory strategies under the banner of research and data collection. Minnesota does not need another layer of government bureaucracy focused on reframing and restricting a constitutional right. The proposal mirrors a recent federal experiment. The former White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention was created to coordinate firearm policy and regulatory initiatives, but it ultimately functioned as a political policy engine. Minnesota should not replicate that model at the state level. Instead of focusing on violent offenders, repeat criminals, and systemic prosecution failures, this bill institutionalizes a public health framing that treats lawful firearm ownership as a societal pathology. The Second Amendment protects a fundamental civil right. It should not be recast as a public health disorder. Minnesota taxpayers are already funding a politicized firearms litigation clinic within the University of Minnesota Law School, commonly referred to as the Gun Violence Prevention Clinic. In practice, that clinic has participated in litigation defending Minnesota's gun control laws, supported legal strategies targeting firearm manufacturers and retailers, and advanced policy positions aligned with national gun control advocacy organizations. Additionally, Minnesota already funds and operates substantial public safety infrastructure. If violence is the concern, the solution lies in enforcement, prosecution, and accountability. Creating another administrative office only creates additional bureaucracy. If this body is serious about reducing violence, the path forward is clear: enforce existing laws against violent felons, address repeat offender release, support law enforcement, ensure meaningful prosecution, and expand direct services for victims, including greater access to mental health services. The Constitution does not prevent Minnesota from punishing violent criminals. It does, however, prevent the state from targeting peaceful citizens for exercising a fundamental right. It is for these reasons that I urge you to vote no on House File 3668. Thank you.
Ms. Leamy, thank you so much for your testimony. And next up, Dr. Rachel Weigert. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Rachel Weigert. Co-Chair Bierman, Co-Chair Backer, and committee members. My name is Dr. Rachel Weigert. I'm a mother, a pediatric emergency medicine physician, and a gun violence prevention researcher, and I'm here to express my full support for House File 3668, which would establish a state office of gun violence prevention. As a researcher, I'm well-versed in the statistics of gun violence in America, including the fact that guns have been the leading cause of death in children since 2020, for 6 years. The extent of this issue rises to the level of a true public health crisis, and like any similar crisis, requires full, multifaceted, evidence-based approach. It is our imperative as leaders in this state to combine our collective resources to tackle this crisis head-on. We have the experts needed to do so, but without a coordinated office, these efforts remain fractured and underfunded. As an emergency room physician, I have seen the devastating impact of this crisis firsthand. I was working in the emergency department at Children's Minnesota the day of the Annunciation shooting. That shift began like many others, waking up early for my 7 a.m. start. My husband was driving our girls to their well child checks that morning, texting me with questions and later noting that it was odd that he was passing so many ambulances heading in the same direction. He knew something was wrong, and moments later, we got the call from Emergency Medical Services that we would be receiving a 10-year-old with a gunshot wound to the head. We were almost immediately updated that this was an active shooter situation at a school. As a level one pediatric trauma center, our staff trained regularly to be able to respond to these kinds of tragic events. The Annunciation shooting was the largest singular trauma incident we have responded to in recent history. It should go without saying, but any bullet can do an incredible amount of damage, especially to a child's small body. A bullet from an automatic rifle is designed to splinter into dozens of twisted metal shards, which can instantly kill a child. When this type of bullet strikes tissue, it begins to topple end over end and create a significant internal defect almost the size of a torso of a young child. The conversations I had with my patients that day still haunt me. The juxtaposition of one child telling me that he was shot in the back while laying on top of his friend, likely saving his friend's life, against his innocent excitement at having received a new Matchbox truck from our child life team. Another young girl instinctively laid on top of her first grade little buddy, shielding them from the spray of bullets. As I removed bullet fragments from her arm and leg, she asked how we could leave the fragment in her skull, knowing that it would be there every time she brushed her hair, every day. Medically, I can answer these questions, but as an adult, I truly feel that we have failed our children for 6 years. My children, your children, and any child that calls Minnesota home deserves to know that they can stay safe from gun violence, whether at home, school, church, or anywhere in our community. Establishing an Office of Gun Violence Prevention would provide a centralized method for research and collaboration on this issue.
Excuse me, Doctor, if you could wrap up your testimony, please.
Positioning Minnesota as a leader in preventing gun violence in our communities. I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. That is the end of the people on the list. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Seeing none. Vice Chair Nadeau, I see you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to offer and explain your amendment?
I would. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bierman, for the work that you're doing on this bill. And I appreciate the number of conversations that you and I have had on this bill. And, Madam Speaker, I do move the A2, and I would like to speak to it.
Please proceed.
All right. So, members, what the A2 does is it simply changes the hosting of this Office of Gun Violence Prevention from the Department of Health to the Department of Public Safety. Now, there's a couple of dozen states that have Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Some have been created by executive order under the governor's office. Some are run by the attorney general's office. Some are run under the Department of Health, and some are under the Department of Public Safety. And I think that, you know, I look at this, and I think this is an important component moving forward. And I think we need to continue discussing this issue, the impact of this. And as you look at gun violence prevention, successful gun violence prevention initiatives across the country. There's a number. There's one in Baltimore that's primarily led by violence interrupters, more of a social service component. But the one that's been the most effective is actually in Boston, and it's Operation Ceasefire. Operation Ceasefire has reduced youth shootings by 63%, overall gun violence, average monthly shootings by 73%, which we all know, if we reduce gun violence, we're going to reduce the trauma associated with gun violence. One of the reasons that I think that probably, I've got three reasons that I think that it should be run by the Department of Public Safety rather than the Department of Health, and that is we already have integrated data and information sharing at that level, BCA, FBI, local law enforcement, Department of Public Safety, corrections. I think there's also an enhanced legitimacy and accountability there, as these are leaders. You know, you look at how community policing has changed over the past 10 years. I mean, it used to be more robust, reaction-based, and today we've got specialized units that deal with mental health. They deal with maternal issues. They deal with group home issues. They deal with health issues, health and safety issues, and I think that they have an incredibly proven track record of adapting in the response, because ultimately that's who shows up first. I think that also the public safety ecosystem is a little bit better suited, and bringing in, there was a testifier from the University of Minnesota, the Gun Violence Prevention Clinic, you know, taking that work and incorporating that into our response, I think would be a healthy move. And the most important thing for me is that, you know, we already have measures of effectiveness, and these are data points that we want to be able to look at, set strong, hard goals, work toward, and hopefully achieve. I think that's where I'm coming from. And Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me. After speaking with Representative Bierman, we're going to continue to discuss this, and I am going to, at this point, withdraw this amendment.
Thank you, Vice Chair Nadeau. Appreciate you speaking to your amendment. And now we'll go to discussion for the bill. And first up is Chair Backer.
Thank you. And I will ditto what Vice Chair said. I know Chair Bierman's been working hard on this. And as an EMT, I have some, of course, concerns with life and death and so forth. Though I do have some concerns. I do have some concerns. Because if we look at Minnesota has been spending tremendous amount of dollars in preventing violence. If we look at it, Minnesota Department of Public Safety, $30 million. We have the CCIP grant, $30 million. CCIP, $31 million. We also have public safety budget and firearms programs. We also, through the Crime Victim Service Grant, spend $60 million annually. And then we know also that the Minneapolis and Hennepin County puts money into that program. And one of my concerns about this bill is that, you know, when we're looking at an office, is there seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that this office would not have any serious powers to get what you're looking to object, your outcome. So I'm going to ask my question I have for you, Chair Bierman, would you be opposed to investing these dollars for enhancing school safety with officers and also security measures at schools? That seems to me a better avenue. Would you be opposed of doing that?
Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. And you point out, you know, a lot of issues around gun violence, crime prevention, public safety, all of those things kind of lumped together. There's a lot of money, yes, in those areas. And the final point was school safety. And, you know, we do need to be moving effectively in all of those spaces. And I think this is one of the issues as I looked at this subject, the model of the continuum of information for the state of Minnesota as to gun violence prevention, it seems to me it needs something in the center that is coordinating and, you know, data was a big part of this, getting timely data for Minnesota specific by area, and also evaluating the effectiveness of not only current programs of all the things you mentioned, but with what we know when we map this out from a state perspective and know all the players involved, and there are many, as you mentioned, some related, some a little bit indirectly. There's a lot of concerns that we have to continue to address, and this model of continuum, I think, needs that clearinghouse, which the Minnesota Department of Health would invest in epidemiologists to investigate the causes, the patterns, the spread of it, and the affected populations in a more robust, timely way. So to your question, would I rather just put this money towards school safety? I think it's not an either or, I think it's a yes and. And we need to be addressing school safety clearly in an ongoing basis, but it's also the safety of the entire society. And so I think that this would help. And just as a further thought, I would compare this to what I see with the opioid epidemic nationally and in the state of Minnesota. And so I serve on the ORAC, the Office of Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, with Representative Baker. And I've seen how that has moved over the years from a really kind of coordinating all the efforts in all the state and looking, too, at the dollars that are invested across the state to address the opioid epidemic in a holistic way. And I see that not being present in this function of looking at gun violence prevention in the state. And I think we should emulate more of what I've seen over there to create that whole package. And opioids are the third highest cause of death for this age group as well, for kids and adolescents. So it's another problem, and there's the whole range of issues you suggested that are intermingled and co-mingling on this. So I think having the Office of Gun Violence Prevention does not keep us from also looking at schools. We're looking at that in education policy, and we all have to look at that in our communities. And there have been improvements in school safety over the years, but we need to continue that. But it's not just that. So I wouldn't say we put the money there instead of this. I think we have to think about both.
Chair Becker.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate that. Again, I know this is something that's important to you. And, you know, this weekend I was up at the home show in Fargo, and had a constituent out of the blue comes up to me. I never met the constituent, and said to me, you know, Representative Backer, said Jeff, actually, he knew me by my first name. He goes, you know, I think what we really need to do is protect our kids in schools. And that starts with security officers. That starts with security measures. And so I appreciate your interest in looking down that. I think that's something our students need, that type of protection. And we know that if we help with that, we know that we can get measurable results too. So to me, we have limited resources. The state of Minnesota is investing, as I said, and anybody can research that online, money already in prevention of gun violence. I think what we need to do is to put resources in protecting our schools and our students in that type of situation. So that's all I have, and I appreciate this dialogue, and I know we'll be working on this.
Representative Bierman, Chair Bierman.
Just thank you, Chair Backer, for your advice. And I do seek advice from each and every one of you on this, not only at this table, but in this audience.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have some questions about, you know, this is a blank appropriation in fiscal 26 and 27. Can you put some context around what that looks like, what that might mean in actual hard dollars? And then what can you tell us a little bit more about this office? I mean, how many people are we going to have in it, and what's the future? You know, is this going to be a continual blank check? to the taxpayers of Minnesota, or can you give us a little more detail on that?
Yeah, and
Chair
thank
Bierman.
You, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen. Great question, and I did have an amendment I was looking to put forward that would have put some numbers in there and also change a few other words, so that will be coming when we bring this bill back up. So I'm looking at maybe three staff, you know, a director, an epidemiologist, and an associate director, three people probably. So not millions of dollars, no. I'm talking more like three FTEs perhaps as far as dollars go. And, you know, what it looks like and what they're working on is what we've just been talking about, mostly getting data, coordinating the activities of all and interacting with all of the elements that are already out there in the state. As I mentioned on the opioid side of this, you know, we came in and a lot of money was going out to counties and the state and to cities, but there was a lack of that coordination. And so with this department, with this agency, what we would want to do is work on that coordination of identifying much more timely data and coordinating the efforts of all of these organizations to get to a point where we can have more effective evaluation and understand what is working in real time and where we need to put more emphasis to address gun violence in our communities and throughout the state.
Representative? Representative Van Binsberg?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, are we having a duplication of some of the things that your bill is discussing? I mean, do we do some of these programs already through the Office of Justice programs? Is there some duplication going on that you see? Sometimes in government, it sure feels like that often happens. And so curious of your thoughts of that.
Madam Chair. So we haven't started the program yet, and part of this involves the department, as I mentioned, looking at the holistic continuum of what's going on out there, finding those duplications and eliminating them or investing in them more if we need more of that thing. So I'm not the one who's going to be writing the specifics of, you know, which exact things we would need, but I think I might get a few more words from the department themselves. I believe Ms. Diamond might be present. And she could be maybe give us a little more detail.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, I'm Dr. Catherine Diamond, the director of the Injury Prevention and Mental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And so I believe the question.
So, Madam Chair, I believe the question is there duplication going on? How would the department handle that? How could we eliminate duplication? And what would be sort of the beginning structural things that you would put in place with such an office to specifically look at gun violence in the state of Minnesota?
So as someone who works at the Department of Health, I can't speak to my colleagues at DPS, but from the preliminary conversations that we have had around this topic, there is not duplication. DPS, it's my understanding, does great work with crime victim services, violence interrupters, so once violence has happened, to make sure that it doesn't happen again, which is one of the leading causes of gun violence is retaliation. However, using a public health lens, we use data and working with people in different areas of the field to look at the protective factors and the risk factors for violence even starting, and really looking to get to those root causes so that the violence doesn't even happen. So there isn't retaliation. It doesn't happen in the first place. So that's where the public health lens really comes in, is basing our actions on data around those topics. As was mentioned, tobacco, seat belts, motor vehicle crash, substance use disorder, those are all topics that we've worked in and have created these collaborative work groups, task forces, whatever is necessary to bring people together at the same table to talk about what is already happening, to avoid that duplication and build where there's opportunity to build on successful initiatives and fill in gaps where there is, where work is not happening. So we do have experience in that. So that's where I would see our first steps being, is really bringing people to the table and building on these conversations that are already happening now to identify those opportunities and those gaps and see where we can use existing resources and then figure out what we need to do when those resources don't exist yet.
Thank you, Dr. Diamond. I'm going to do a quick time check here, and I'm going to quote my second favorite chair of the health committee and say we're going to try and land this plane at 2 o'clock. Did you have one more follow-up?
I just would like to make one last comment. You know, I'm concerned about the blank appropriation. It's just a lot of money that I think if we're going to be bringing bills out, we should have the details and a fiscal note to them prior to moving them. So thank you,
Representative Lee.
A huge chair, committee. This is not, let me be clear, a gun ownership issue. It is a gun violence issue. And even in those terms, you've heard it today, the use of the word firearms versus guns, because we want to move from guns to people, right? That's how the saying, that's what the saying is, right? Guns don't kill people. People kill people. So let's focus on the people. Mm-hmm. The city of Brooklyn Park, where I'm from, we helped to pilot the first mental health alternative response team in partnership with our local police department. And it was super successful. You can look at all the data. Brought all the incidents down and helped so many residents with resources. Law enforcement needed that extra help because they hadn't been able to deal with it up to this point. And I applaud everyone involved in helping to make that happen. So MDH already sees firearms violence as a public health issue. And they're trying to address it, and they can, in this bill, partner with DPS and all of the great interagency work that's already being done. So I think that would be a great partnership, just like how the Brooklyn Park Police Department teamed up with mental health and other social workers to create an alternative response team. Issues like suicide, alcohol and substance abuse, domestic violence, etc., these are not law enforcement issues. These are public health issues. So I ask you to please support this bill to put this program in the Department of Health. Thank you.
Thank you. And just for the record, a fiscal note has been requested. Next up, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Lee, for the segue that I wanted to talk about, and its people. And it's the mental health piece of this. And I also just personally want to thank all those that are here in the room that sent us emails, also shared your testimony for and against this bill. We appreciate the feedback, and it's always really helpful in this work. So I'm just gonna shift to mental health. We talk about people committing these crimes, and they are, the instance that we just heard today, a lot referenced this tragedy here in Minnesota. Was a mentally ill person. And so I just want to ask the chair, would your office, would this new office create Would the focus be on the gun violence, and would it reduce suicide? Would it reduce, you know, casualties in the sense of if 50% of our folks that are dying in our state and around the nation are by suicide, would it target the mental health aspect of it?
Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair. Certainly it's a bill about gun violence, and suicide is, I've seen statistics that it's up to 70% suicides. So any violence, you know, that is happening with a gun, and there's a lot of commingling, just as I talk about SUD issues, that, you know, it's not just people who are using opioids or fentanyl. There's a lot of commingling going on. It's the same, you know, with this situation. 20% or more of us have mental health issues at some point. And so, mental health, while we try and sometimes talk about it individually, it's always commingling into these situations. And I guess I will turn again to Ms. Diamond for any comment about how mental health would factor into this.
Dr. Diamond.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you. I think it was a great response. You know, mental health is one piece of this, and truly there's a difference between mental illness and mental health. And I think that at MDH, we tend to focus on mental health, mental well-being, making sure that communities have the supports and the resources they need for mental wellness in the community, which is certainly tied to decreased incidents of violence. And so I can't predict what we would find when we look into our, you know, landscape analysis of what programs are needed or what we should kind of beef up. But I would place a heavy bet that that mental well-being and mental health would be a strategy that communities would welcome and would improve rates of violence, specifically gun violence.
Representative Gilman.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chair. I'll just do one quick follow-up, if you don't mind. So MDH is focused on the mental wellness piece of it. And as we see nationally and even in our state, would you take into consideration if people are on medications that may cause, you know, the side effects say, this may cause this, you know? And so when you talk about mental, you know, health and illness, sometimes medications people are on are taking can cause them to, you know, we're finding to have agitation. And so I'm just curious if you're going to factor in the medications that people are on as well that commit these heinous crimes.
Chair Bierman or Dr. Diamond?
Thank you for the question. If you'd like to answer.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, I think moving to the condition of one patient involves kind of a, you know, it's an important consideration, definitely. When we're looking at the spectrum of mental health care, mental health, mental illness, pharmaceutical drugs that people are on, you're kind of pulling together like one specific thing. And I think, are you asking, would we be able to zero in and identify that as the cause of something? I mean, we're kind of in a little bit of a vague area here. As far as how that would be, you know, we have to focus in our medical health system about patient-centered care. So when you're thinking about an individual and what medications they're on, I think and I hope that and I know that doctors are trying to do the best they can for that patient. The worry that maybe that person is going to harm himself or herself, or that person is going to turn into a school shooter, you know, all are things that we're trying to figure out. But there's many times when you look, you know, deeper at school shooters that you would not know from a mental health perspective that they had a condition because they weren't evaluated or that it wasn't prevalent at the point of their attack. So we're kind of on a gray area as far as how I can even answer that question. And I know I'm probably for you not satisfying you, but it is a tough thing to answer. But it is certainly something that when you're looking at gun violence, we're going to get into the entity and the business of it and see what's on the map and try to take those types of things into consideration as best as possible.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much.
We have two more people on the list. If you could keep your remarks concise, I'd appreciate it. Next up is Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I'll be very quick. I was going to go on about the Second Amendment. I don't believe that prohibits legitimate, reasonable gun control. But that said, I want to thank the Annunciation parents who came. I see one that I saw last week at Wayzata Community Church at that forum, which was very, very moving. And thank you for your leadership. Thank you for what you're doing. And also the chairs or the desks outside the hearing room, one floor down, Harper and Fletcher's desks. I tell you, it brought me to tears. I mean, it's so moving. And to think that that's their stuff and they're not here anymore. We have to be able to do something. So with that said, thank you, Chair Bierman, for bringing this bill. I'm honored to be a co-sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, thank you for bringing this bill. It feels like after 5 years of this being the number one injury to our youth, young people in Minnesota, we owe it to them and we owe it to future generations. And for me, this lands very squarely in the public health sector, and thank you for your leadership. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Chair Bierman, closing comments.
I just want to thank the committee and the testifiers and all the people who came up for this hearing. It's nice to have a bill where we don't take an up or down vote right now, and I think it enables us to further work on this bill. It will be coming back, and I want to have the input of all of you on it going forward. I will just say that all bills reflect values, and this bill reflects the value of the importance of our youngest citizens who are in they're in a bad place when they're their top cause of their death in this country is gun violence. So we need to do better, we can do better, and this committee can help do that right here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Chair Bierman renews the motion that House File 3668 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. And with that, I'll pass the gavel back to Chair Bierman.
How's your birthday, Mary?
Oh, my God, I'm sorry.
We'll just let the room clear out a little bit before we resume. Next on the agenda are two bills concerning health entity ownership. Vice Chair Ryer, I understand that you have testifiers who will be presenting on both bills before we take them up. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So I believe we will start with Dr. Singh from Brown University. Is he on video? Dr. Singh, if you can hear us, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your presentation, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Yashaswini Singh. Thank you, co-chairs Becker and Bierman and members of the House Health Finance and Policy Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today to provide an overview of private equity investments in healthcare. I am an economist by training and a professor at Brown. I also serve on the advisory council of the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, a consumer watchdog and advocacy organization interested in private equity investments in all sectors of the American economy. I wanted to start by providing an overview of PE investments in healthcare. Private equity firms have invested over $1 trillion in the American healthcare system over the last two or two and a half decades. This has really accelerated starting in the period, as you can see on the chart, around 2015 onwards. I also wanted to spend a brief moment describing to you how private equity in particular might differ from other types of private or for-profit ownership in healthcare.
Excuse Dr. Singh, could you speak up just a little louder? I think we have maxed out on audio here, and if you could speak a little louder, that would be helpful, please. Thank you.
Absolutely. I hope this is better. I thought I would provide an overview of how private equity in particular differs from other types of private or for-profit ownership and investments in healthcare. Generally, private equity firms rely on large amounts of debt to acquire majority or controlling stakes in the targets that they invest in. Investors typically have a short time horizon, generally investing for a period of 3 to 7 years. And they often seek returns that far exceed market averages, often upwards of 20%. And so the emphasis really is on rapid value creation and exit rather than long-term investments. Off note, PE firms have very few systematic disclosure or transparency or reporting requirements. There are very limited requirements on ownership structures, financing, or performance. This makes it incredibly difficult for researchers, policymakers, patients, and healthcare workers to understand which entity is operated or controlled by PE investors, and most importantly, what the effects of these trends are on healthcare prices, access, quality, as well as workforce considerations. I also wanted to highlight that there is no such thing as a common PE strategy. PE firms operate in distinct ways in distinct healthcare settings. For example, it is common for investors to follow a platform and add-on consolidation strategy when investing in outpatient practices, such as physician offices. But on the other hand, it is also common for investors to rely on sale-leaseback agreements that separate the property company from the operating company, which is commonly seen in investments in hospitals and nursing homes. A little bit more detail on that point. I already highlighted PE firms' extensive use of debt to finance the transaction. Combined with capital that is raised from limited partners, PE firms can use large amounts of debt to make a majority stake investment. In this illustrative example, in a platform practice of three physicians in one practice, depending on the state corporate of practice medicine doctrine, this can be accomplished via the use of a management services organization, an independent entity that often provides administrative support for back-end functions. The platform and add-on consolidation takes this form. What starts as an initial acquisition of three physicians in one practice is followed by an add-on acquisition of a practice with two physicians, add-on acquisition of practice B of a solo practitioner, and add-on acquisition of practice C with four physicians. Together, this platform and add-on model gives the same firm control over 10 physicians, even though each individual acquisition was too small to trigger any sort of reporting or disclosure requirement. Importantly, this type of roll-up consolidation offers the PE investor market share, the ability to benefit from economies of scale, and then exit the investment for a higher valuation. Theoretically, PE firms can exit their investments via taking the investment public, listing it on a public stock exchange via an IPO, selling to another private equity firm via a secondary buyout, or selling to a corporate entity that might be a health insurer or a hospital system. Now, theoretically, while each of these is equally plausible, my research has shown that to date, physician practice exits take the form of secondary buyouts, where PE firms sell their investment targets to other PE firms. The reason I lay this out in this flowchart is to highlight to you that no part of what I illustrate here is formally reported or disclosed in any capacity, making it virtually impossible to track which firms invest in which entities, which communities are exposed to the benefits or the harms of these investments, and also when and what form PE exits take. Now, I have spent the last 5 years studying the effects of these trends, compiling data from hand-collected sources and very expensive proprietary private databases. I wanted to highlight for you what some of this research has found. While there are theoretical benefits of private investment, in general, these have not been supported by empirical research studies. The evidence to date shows that PE investments in outpatient practices increase the cost of care by 10 to 26%, depending on the specific service being examined. PE investors also increase the use of ancillary services such as lab tests and imaging services. There are also some workforce changes that materialize following acquisitions, such as a heavy reliance on advanced practice providers and a greater turnover among physician staff employed by these practices, perhaps signaling an overall dissatisfaction with the performance-oriented nature of work under financial investors. There is also research that PE investors harm patient care, specifically in the hospital setting and the nursing home setting. We see a higher incidence of adverse events as well as patient mortality. The effects of PE on quality of care in the physician setting is more mixed, finding marginal, if any, changes. I also wanted to highlight for you some specific data on Minnesota. Nationally, PE firms currently own and operate over one-third of methadone clinics or opioid treatment programs. This is an area of bipartisan policy concern, given that opioid treatment programs are the only licensed setting where methadone can be dispensed. In Minnesota, we have compiled data that shows PE firms currently operate about 20% of the state's opioid treatment programs, and national data show that these investments have not led to an expansion of methadone access or any change in patient mortality. I finally wanted to highlight for you a resource that is compiled by the Private Equity Stakeholder Project. This is a resource that compiles what is referred to as a private equity's risk index, an approximation of PE involvement in each state across the U.S. The Private Equity Risk Index gives Minnesota a risk score of 46 on 100. I wanted to highlight for you that while this resource exists, it is most certainly an underestimate, an undercount of PE involvement in healthcare, notably because of the restrictions on transparency and reporting that we discussed earlier. Finally, to conclude, I wanted to highlight for you, PE in healthcare across the country has manifested in investments across hospitals, physician practices, nursing homes, as well as opioid treatment programs. Most of the evidence to date is national in scope. We are very limited by state-specific data, and as a result, we have really no grasp on how many hospitals or what share of providers across physician practices or nursing homes are currently affiliated by PE investors. And so in sum, I wanted to highlight that PE's growth in healthcare reflects a broader trend towards healthcare corporatization. The evidence to date supports some of the undesirable impacts of these investments, although theoretical benefits might exist in certain cases. Specifically, we are concerned about higher prices across specialties of care, changes to service provision based on profitability, and some workforce disruptions that have implications for patient care and care continuity. I also highlighted for us how PE strategy is sector-specific, which means that there is likely to be heterogeneity in impact across payers, patients, and workers, but state-specific evidence is limited by the fact that there are no transparency or disclosure requirements to date. In sum, I want to close by acknowledging the key regulatory challenge, which is to balance the need for capital investment in healthcare, particularly among smaller independent practices, with protections for patients and healthcare workers. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Dr. Singh. Thank you very much. Next up would be Mr. Sam Brooks.
Hi. Thank you very much, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sam Brooks. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
You could, Mr. Brooks, speak up a little bit louder, please.
Sorry. My name is Sam Brooks. I'm grateful for the opportunity to address the critical problem of private equity investment in nursing homes. I'm a national expert on nursing home policy. I direct the public policy program for the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care. We are a resident and family advocacy organization and been doing this for 50 years. We see daily the negative and deleterious impact private equity investment has on nursing home residents, their families, and nursing home workers. I strongly support the legislature's efforts to protect its most vulnerable citizens through legislation to prevent the ownership of nursing homes by unscrupulous investors who are only concerned with maximizing profits at the expense of care and communities. Over the past decade, as Dr. Singh indicated, private equity firms have rapidly expanded their presence across the nation's long-term care sector. estimates show that private equity now own between 5 to 13% of U.S. nursing homes, although I suspect that number is small, is larger, but as Dr. Singh indicated, it's very hard to tell who owns a nursing home. This rise has occurred despite mounting evidence that private equity's profit-driven acquisition strategies conflict sharply with the needs of vulnerable nursing home residents who rely on stable staffing, transparency, and continuity of care. Private equity investors seek high returns and look to industries with guaranteed cash flow, such as Medicare and Medicaid dollars, and to insufficient oversight and regulation on how that taxpayer dollars are spent. Multiple national studies show that private equity ownership is associated with worse nursing home resident outcomes, including increased mortality, higher rates of pain and pressure ulcers, more hospitalizations, and more serious deficiencies. The most comprehensive systematic reviews covering studies from 2000 to 2024 conclude that private equity ownership and involvement in nursing home care results in declines in quality and increased risk for residents. These negative outcomes are not isolated. They reflect structural financial practices. When facilities are purchased using leveraged buyouts, the nursing home is immediately saddled with debt, diverting funds from staffing and care into interest payments, management fees, and leaseback arrangements with private equity affiliated real estate entities. Studies document increases in management fees, lease costs, and interest expenses after acquisition, with corresponding decreases in quality and long-term financial sustainability. Private equity and other unscrupulous owners use nursing homes as collateral to fund exorbitant mortgages, which are in turn paid directly by the nursing home. These exorbitant capital costs draw money away from residents and workers and result in poor care. Nursing home staffing, especially among certified nursing assistants and licensed practical nurses, declines consistently under private equity ownership. National analyses show reductions in total staffing hours with only minor or inconsistent increases in RN time. Workforce reductions contribute to higher deficiency rates and lower CMS star quality ratings, consistent with findings that private equity-owned facilities rely more heavily on lower-skilled staff and experience significantly high staff turnover. This impacts staff and the communities they live in. Perennially low wages result in workers living at or near the poverty line and relying on public benefits such as food stamps or Medicaid. The dollars diverted away by private equity that were intended to support high-quality, long-term healthcare workforce go to the profits of private equity. Recent years have seen several high-profile bankruptcies among private equity-owned nursing home chains, including LaVie, Consulate Healthcare, Goldner Capital, and Gulf Coast Healthcare. These cases illustrate how debt-heavy, extraction-focused financial models destabilize nursing home operations. These bankruptcies are often structured to allow owners to offload debt while retaining the properties. As a result, the practice repeats itself over and over again. This was evident in the 2025 analysis of the Genesis Healthcare's collapse. It showed how leveraged buyouts burdened facilities with massive debt. Genesis owed $700 million to secured creditors, mostly mortgages, when it filed for bankruptcy, leaving residents and workers vulnerable when the financial model inevitably buckles. The private equity investors sought to offload mortgages, which are in turn paid directly by, offload unsecured debt, mostly civil judgments against them for providing such poor care and retaining the facility. Minnesota lawmakers are beginning to recognize the risk. Bill 2771 and 2972 propose requiring transparency, attorney general approval of acquisitions, and assurances that private equity ownership will not undermine the quality of care or infrastructure. These bills mandate that at least 75% of public program funds be spent on direct resident care, an essential guardrail preventing harmful extraction. This money are sucked out of Minnesota and into the pockets of people living in New York and other places. Older and disabled Minnesotans deserve stability, dignity, and high-quality care, not exposure to the volatility inherent in private equity's short-term extraction-driven business model. Nursing home residents and workers are not financial investments. The evidence is overwhelming. Private equity ownership too often leads to cost-cutting, workforce reductions, operational instability, and even facility collapse. Minnesota has a unique opportunity to lead the nation by adopting strong, evidence-based safeguards that place residents, not investors, at the center of long-term care policy. Thank you for your time. I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify, and I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Brooks. We'll now move to the bills. Representative Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer's first bill today is House File 2779. I will remind members that we heard this bill in committee last session, adopted an amendment, and laid the bill over. So I will move House File 2779 back before the committee to be laid over. And I understand, Vice Chair Ryer, you have been continuing work, and there's another DE1 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment and to explain?
Yes, I move the DE1 amendment. This is provided in order to make it easier as we move forward to have good documentation. We've been, as you probably saw on the website, we had an unofficial endorsement. This takes that unofficial endorsement, which combined our work from last time, and adds a few technical corrections as well, and I ask for your support to approve it.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. I move the adoption of the DE1. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? And the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Ryer, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, members. Today we heard about the growth of private equity in healthcare and the risks that corporatization poses to our healthcare system in terms of cost, system stability, and outcomes. That's why we had the presentations first, in order to ground us all in the structure and nature and the impact of private equity. But this growth also undermines the system's foundation. At the core of it, it's about people helping people take care of their health. Healthcare relies on a simple relationship, the connection between the caregiver and the person needing care. It's a very personal one, laden with vulnerability and unequal power, and one that relies on trust. Patients need to know that their well-being is the top priority when they're seeking care, and they need to know that those making decisions about their care are qualified to make those decisions. These are the root sources of trust. When the business of healthcare was simpler, bestowing trust was easier because we knew the people we were dealing with. With consolidation, corporatization, and financialization, instead of just doing business with our personal caregivers, we're thrust into dealings with complex and impersonal business entities. We may not even know who we're dealing with. We've gone far from our local provider. Corporate actors like large healthcare systems, insurance companies, and pharmacy benefit managers set rules that can control providers' behavior. We're required to trust that these entities put the well-being of patients and not corporate business needs first. We're also required to trust that our health comes first when financial actors such as private equity become deeply entwined in the healthcare system. Not only that, we have to trust that taxpayer dollars are being used appropriately and not at the expense of taxpayers or patients. In any case, trust must be earned, and trust without information isn't possible. House File 2779, the Healthcare Accountability Act, gives us the information we need about the current state of consolidation and corporate investment in healthcare. Article 1 defines the information needed for the public, regulators, and legislators to be able to understand who's running the show in locations like the exam room, hospital room, nursing home, surgery center, radiology center, or hospice. It addresses gaps in transparency around ownership and financing of health systems. And these additions in Article 1 ensure that we see the relationships within our increasingly complex, vertically and horizontally integrated healthcare systems. Article 2 protects patients by putting limits on the decisions that non-medical professionals can make. It's the realm of licensed medical professionals to determine how much time to spend with patients, what the diagnoses are, and what treatments are appropriate. These are the decisions that have been increasingly taken from the caregivers we trust. This is important legislation to get our healthcare system back on track and reduce some of the harm that's been occurring. It supports maintaining service availability, quality of care, and program integrity. Above all, it enables health trust in the system. Please support House File 2779.
Thank you, Vice Chair Iyer. We'll move to testifiers. First up is Christine Sundberg, and also then on deck, Dan Andreessen. Good afternoon. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Bierman and members of the committee. I'm Christine Sundberg, and I'm Executive Director of Elder Voice Advocates. We work to advocate elder justice and quality care by promoting oversight, transparency, and accountability in long-term care. I'm here in strong support of both House File 2771 and House File 2779. Minnesota's long-term care system is failing too many older adults, especially the for-profit operators. Our review of the Minnesota Department of Health 2025 substantiated investigations found that nearly 80% of the abuse, neglect, and exploitation was by for-profit facilities. We also identified 23 deaths, and 21 of those deaths were in for-profit facilities. There were no recorded fines for any of those deaths, and 19 of the providers had a very poor record of substantiated investigations. The full report is in your packets. Yet the maximum fine when a resident dies due to neglect is just $5,000, a cost of doing business, not a meaningful deterrent, and certainly not a true value on a life lost too early. The penalty for animal abuse can be up to 2 years in prison and up to $10,000 in fines and restitution for the costs. These are real people, not just numbers. One Golden Valley resident slowly suffocated to death while staff stood by and looked on with no help being given. Another Plymouth resident had their leg amputated because of untreated wounds. A Waconia person was left on a bedpan for 11 and a half hours. In Savage, a resident fell from the bed and repeatedly calling for help, but the staff was asleep.
Ms. Sundberg, could you wrap up your testimony, please?
I think I brought, my point here. We need the transparency of this legislation, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, and Mr. Andreessen, if you'd introduce yourself and proceed in 2 minutes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, trade association representing Minnesota's nonprofit insurers. As was mentioned, private equity acquisitions have increased over the past decade, with many targeting entities which are struggling financially or who show short-term profit potential. Although private equity acquisitions may bring technological and operational efficiencies, some use these acquisitions to generate quick profits by taking advantage of our primarily fee-for-service payment model, which rewards volume over outcomes. This is especially seen in healthcare services, which have a short-term relationship with patients. This can include services such as diagnostic imaging, gastroenterology, ophthalmology, dermatology, OBGYN, infertility clinics, dental practices, durable medical equipment, and surgical centers. Private equity firms use a number of tactics to boost revenue, including overprescription of tests, performing low-value procedures, and using inaccurate billing codes to inflate reimbursements, also known as upcoding. Beyond practice acquisition, we've also seen private equity-backed providers introduce and support legislation that may benefit them financially. This includes legislation to reduce credentialing timelines, reduce or eliminate prior authorization, and enact coverage mandates for services within their practice area. There is little to no transparency or oversight of private equity involvement in Minnesota's healthcare system. And as some healthcare entities continue to struggle, especially large hospitals, we should be mindful of increased investment and chart a path that keeps patients a top priority. It is my understanding, though, that there is some concerns over the language, and we're probably not at the proverbial peace in the valley, so I hope that the work continues on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for the testimony. Next, we have Dr. Amy Gilbert online, and followed by Dana Seifert, also online. And a reminder to speak up online, and 2 minutes, please.
Good afternoon, Representative Bierman and committee members. I'm Dr. Amy Gilbert, a family practice physician who trained in Minnesota, and I practiced here in a variety of settings for 30 years. I speak in support of House File 2779 as an example of physician experience in an investor-owned clinic. It was a startup providing primary care for seniors. When I was recruited, I was assured that we would have ongoing training in geriatrics. We would have continuing education, chart reviews, and case consults. But soon the focus shifted. The number of patients each day increased, visits got shorter, our time for medical learning was eliminated. Most of our training from leadership was about entering diagnostic codes for highly reimbursed diagnoses. Here quickly are some notes from staff training. A cognitive assessment can be its own visit. You can code a non-face-to-face encounter as part of a diagnostic assessment 3 days prior, 7 days after. If the total interaction is over 99 minutes, you can code 6212 for extra time. You can bill for a cognitive assessment every 180 days, and on and on. Is this what you want your doctor studying? The organization hired more and more employees to deal with billing, technology, and insurance, but not for patient care. Consistent with Sam Brooks' comments, support staff reviewed charts before the patient's first visit to highlight diagnostic codes most important for billing purposes. Clinicians became demoralized. Lunchtime was changed to unpaid. The workday was lengthened, and visit time with patients was shortened. Some days I worked 14 hours. The startup business had to satisfy their investors, so growth was a priority over quality patient care. This is the reason I retired a year sooner than I meant to. Minnesota has a growing shortage of primary care physicians. As Dr. Singh noted, this experience where the business and profit concerns run the practice more than the medical care of patients is a major reason that physicians are retiring early and leaving practice. Please pass the Healthcare Accountability Act. Doctors want to focus not on finances, but on taking care of patients. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gilbert. Next up, Dana Seifert. Please introduce yourself and proceed, and 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Bierman and Backer and members of the committee. My name is Dana Seifert. I've been a practicing physical therapist in Minnesota for 14 years and a member of Minnesota Farmers Union for 3. And everything I'm about to tell you in support of HF 2771 and HF 2779 are my own views. First, may I please encourage everyone who's been seated for more than 15 minutes to gently move and stretch their head and shoulders and take a few deep breaths to ease your muscle tension as I relate to you a tale of two patients. My first job as a new provider was at a medical campus, including a skilled nursing facility, assisted living, and recently expanded transitional care unit. Patient one was recovering spectacularly after joint replacement surgery. Roomed in the new TCU wing, they could walk up and down stairs, across the new outdoor treatment area on sidewalk, grass, wood chips, using only a cane when many patients would be moving only indoors using a walker. I congratulated them, said, plan for a ride home tomorrow. They replied their kitchen remodel was taking longer than expected, so they would like to stay until it was all cleaned up. My manager said, write new PT goals. We'll keep them on caseload out of hospitality. I declined to sign off on any documentation for billing as TCU level physical therapy was not actually needed. My manager proceeded to treat the patient personally. Meanwhile, patient two was recovering from an unexpected loss of mobility that took them from being a totally independent adult to not being able to dress, feed themselves, walk, or even sit up in bed without help. They were roomed in the older wing of the TCU and making slow but good progress in their recovery. One day, my manager said to prepare to discharge this person who couldn't yet stand without support but had to navigate steps to enter their home. When I explained they needed more time, I was told that this patient had lousy insurance, and the number of days they were allowed was up. So they were shipped home before they could even sit at the side of a bed to get dressed. This all occurred without the pressure to prioritize budgetary goals seen when private equity is allowed into facilities that ostensibly exist to provide care. So quite aside from the moral repugnance I personally carry towards the very concept of equity wanting to make a buck on the back of people's health needs, I shared my experiences specifically so you could hear that even a novice healthcare provider knew when to walk away from a bad situation.
Ms. Seifert, we'll need you to finish up.
To claim giving private equity a stake in care facilities wouldn't incentivize malpractice and provider flight, given what we all heard from Dr. Singh and Mr. Brooks, requires a degree of either deliberate naivete or mercenary capitalism that would be frankly concerning. The function of private equity is to compete in a marketplace and earn dividends for investors. Those motivations have no ethical place in healthcare, and private equity doesn't belong anywhere near where healthcare decisions are made for Minnesotans.
Thank you, Ms. Seifert. Any members of the public wishing to testify? Is that a slip?
Whoa. Did you want to force wishing, it instead?
Wishing. I seeing none. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who this question would go to, but in our packets there is one stapled piece entitled Exhibit 4. And I had a question about that first. Who submitted it? And then it's come to my attention that the final page in this Exhibit 4, which apparently came from something in Wisconsin, includes information about Allina Health System, and that is not actually part of Exhibit 4 as it was originally filed. And so my first question is, where did this come from, and why is this Allina Health piece included in this particular packet?
Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Schumacher. So there are two pieces there. One is an Allina org chart that was constructed by an organization known as NASHP from public information. And if you look at, so the last page is separate. If you just pull it off like that, you have the two exhibits you should have. And these are included simply to show that in even relatively well-known local healthcare systems, there is a lot that the average person wouldn't understand, and there's a lot of complexity that happens. They are not meant as anything other than a lesson in the complexity of our system. I did not have attached the 200-plus Sunlight report on United Health Group that is fascinating to read, and I'm happy to send out a link. But we're living in a very complex set of interacting systems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that some of the concern was, especially after I pulled it out of the staple, it does help with that. But when it was listed as an exhibit, I would have understood it as having some efficacy and accuracy or the ability to back up what was being listed in there. And it's my understanding as well that this information may have been pulled from 990s from NASHP, you said? NASHB?
National Association of State Health Plans. And yes, you can see, oh, I'm sorry, Chair. You can see the sources that they used in the bottom right-hand corner of the Allina one. Exhibit 4 refers to exhibits to form a statement regarding Security Health Plan of Wisconsin, Inc. So this is part of this part, the Exhibit 4, is part of a filing in the state of Wisconsin related to Sanford Health, which also operates in Minnesota.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those the responses for that. And so so this chart, especially for Allina, that's put in here from the state health plans there, they pulled that information from 990s, but there is no but it's based off of those 990s. There's no reconciliation for accuracy on this and how this, it's just one person's interpretation from what the 990s say for how they would put that org chart together.
Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, it is a compendium of statements from an audited financial statement, a compendium from AHRQ, the NASHP cost tool, all public sources, Allina's legacy health profile. But I'd encourage you to go back to the purpose of this. The purpose of this is to help people understand how complicated the system is. And so we could certainly talk about how complicated this system is until the end of our committee time, but I'm also happy to take this conversation in more detail, unless there's a specific bit that you'd like to follow up on.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that, I guess, satisfies me on the Allina piece for that. I do have a question about the Sanford piece in the Exhibit 4, and I was wondering if there was anyone who could speak to that that's here today.
Yes. Representative Schumacher, please proceed to the table and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nick Sirwas, Capital Associates. Our firm represents Sanford Health in a contractual basis.
And question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was introduced for illustrative purposes, and I was just kind of curious, is Sanford a part of a private equity firm at all, or how is the organization composed?
Yeah, I can follow up with the
Mr. Chair,
members. I can certainly follow up with the committee with additional details and information of anything that folks want. I can, however, fully say that we are a nonprofit health company that does not play a role in any way with private equity funding. We're not privately, we don't have private equity that funds our operations. We have not operated in that capacity whatsoever. That exhibit, I believe, was submitted as a part of the review regarding the recent acquisition Sanford had with Marshfield Health and Marshfield Clinics in Wisconsin. That was part of a disclosure process that was processed through that transaction. Sanford, based out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, operates in multiple states as a not-for-profit, to make that clear, health operation that owns some pharmacies, some health clinics, some long-term care facilities, and some hospitals. We do not participate in private equity operations or anything of the sort.
Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony and your clarification. I think that the point of these is being missed. This is an example of two local nonprofit systems that homegrown companies that we know and are familiar with. And for the average person who might want to understand who owns and who runs a portion of this group in their community, it could be confusing. For example, just the difference in naming Southwest Minnesota Radiation Center, LLC, Good Samaritan Insurance Plan of Nebraska, Inc., the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Foundation. My point is to say these systems are complicated and confusing, and people need guidance and information. With Allina Health Systems, account receivable Services, LLC, Access Healthcare, LLC, AH Franchising, LLC, Mobile Imaging Services, BPA Health, and I could go on and on. It's not easy, even with a homegrown system like Allina, for people to understand it. And so just think, when you get into private equity and all these other people, how much more difficult it is.
Vice Chair Iyer, we have 1 minute. I'm just going to ask if Representative Van Binsbergen and Representative Backer could take their questions offline so that we could let you do a final closing. And we are laying the bill over, so it is not moving out of the committee. And if that would be all right, please proceed with a closing, and we will wrap up committee.
My closing, thank you, Mr. Chair. My closing is that I am going to guess that many of my colleagues over to my left have questions and curiosity about this. So if you happen to have a committee caucus that you would like me to come and talk about this, it would be a great opportunity to really hash through and explain. And that is something I would be happy to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Breyer. And with that, I will renew the motion to lay over House File 2779 as amended for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. Now we will come to an adjournment. Thank you all for your attention today, and we are adjourned.